February 28th, 2017, meeting of the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness is here. We actually do have a quorum, though it may not look like it. We have 5 of 8, which is a quorum. For those that are trying to follow with the agenda, we're going to move things around just a little bit. We're going to actually move the potential of introducing a committee bill down to the very end of today. We have one bill that I'm going to ask folks to entertain for that particular motion. In the meantime, however, we're going to start with an informational meeting. I'm going to open the informational meeting and call up Dr. Chris Goldfinger. And if Ian Madden and John Corr would like to come up as a panel, you're welcome to, or you can come up one at a time. You are the main attraction here today on February 28th. We're looking very much forward to this. And as noted, we do have a soundtrack we could play, but we're not. We're going to be disciplined. If we can get the lights, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Representative Evans and members of the committee for the invitation. I'm Chris Goldfinger from Morgan State University. I'm mainly an earthquake geologist, study subduction zone earthquakes.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, my name is Ian Maiden. I'm the Chief Scientist and Deputy Director for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries.
Excellent. Dr. Goldfinger, okay. The floor is yours.
Thank you for the invitation. And I've been asked to update the committee on the science of great earthquakes in Cascadia, how we know what we know, how confident are we, some updates and probabilities, and maybe make some comments about related societal issues. So here's a sorry, these maps are a little bit squashed in this projector, but anyway, so here's Cascadia, and find the right buttons here. So here we are. Here's the continental shelf, and this bright line between the dark blue and the light blue is the boundary between North America and the Juan de Fuca plates. And the Juan de Fuca's plate is subducting underneath North America at about 35 millimeters a year, about as fast as your fingernails grow, which doesn't sound like much, but over a couple of hundred years, you begin to accumulate a lot of strain between these two plates, which are apparently completely locked at this point. And so our knowledge of this thing really started in about 1984, 1985. Prior to that, plate tectonics was only about 20 years old at the time, and prior to the mid-80s, Cascadia was just considered an odd subduction zone that was completely quiet. And Pacific Northwest, with the exception of a few earthquakes around Seattle, essentially didn't have earthquakes and nobody worried about it. So we went ahead and built our cities and infrastructure on top of something we didn't understand at the time. And so in 1984, 1985, a guy named John Adams found some of the first evidence offshore. And shortly after that, Brian Atwater found evidence along the coastal marshes in places like Willapa Bay that looked like this. And what this is a modern marsh up here, some bay mud, a tsunami sand sheet down here, and an old marsh down below. And what this shows is that the land level had dropped about a meter, and Brian was able to show that this land level drop wasn't slow, that it was very rapid. We had plants actually buried in sand. And so so Brian was able to demonstrate that Cascadia was not a quiet subduction zone, somehow chugging along aseismically, or a dead subduction zone, but actually that the needle went full the other direction and became a subduction zone that could generate magnitude 9 or greater earthquakes, which is not super good news for the Pacific Northwest. And finally, this paradigm change that happened was sort of sealed
Dr.
in about 1993.
Dr. Goldfinger, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question to go back to. Is that the same slide?
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, just lack of science knowledge. So you said it was Mr. Adams was the first to suggest. Is he the one that made that cut, I guess you would call it, and then found? How does one decide to go do that, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. I just find that fascinating.
Well, Adams, I'll get to that in just a sec.
Okay.
John was the first, and I'll explain how that happened.
Okay.
And then that cut that you saw, this cut here, was really more of an accident. You know, you can go out there with a little army shovel to almost any of the bays in the Pacific Northwest and cut that away by hand, and you'll see stratigraphy that looks just like that. And so the question was, how do you do that? How do you get a marsh up here and a marsh down there a meter lower?
Yeah.
And the critters that live in the marsh are really sensitive to the tide level. So either the height of the ocean changed really quickly or the height of the land changed really quickly, and the evidence showed it was the land that moved and not the ocean. And so... It's a bit of a long story.
Okay.
But it showed very rapid land level change. And really the only way you can do that is with an earthquake.
Hmm. Okay, thank you.
And so anyway, this story has been developing for more than 30 years, and dozens of people have been working on this up and down the coast in every coastal bay and offshore as well. And one of the key bits of evidence was the fact that a tsunami arrived in Japan in the year 1700, and it didn't have an earthquake with it, and became known as the orphan tsunami. And the Japanese were very familiar with earthquake-tsunami pairs, and this one came and actually did a fair amount of damage and came without an earthquake. And so the records in Japan showed that the most likely source of this tsunami was not Alaska, it was not Kamchatka, it was not Chile or Peru, it was Cascadia. And so after a few years of sleuthing, Atwater and his colleagues and Kenji Satake concluded that this last Cascadia earthquake arrived January 26th in the year 1700, about 9 o'clock at night. And so for geology, that's pretty precise. And I score that as a win for the earth sciences. And so here's how you develop that stratigraphy. The upper plate in this case is the weaker plate, and as they're locked, it flexes upward like this. Over time, after a few hundred years, it then lets go and subsides. And so when the coast subsides, you take your forest and you dunk it into the bay by about a meter or so. 20 minutes later, the tsunami comes in, buries the base of the tree in a sand sheet, kills the tree from salt water, and then you wind up with this very familiar scene of snag trees in the bays. And if you dig like Brian did, you'll see this kind of stratigraphy. So this is now very well known, and there's really no alternative hypothesis to it that anyone has come up with. And we tried, believe me. So this is what a cutaway of the subduction zone looks like at about the latitude of Corvallis or so. So this is North America. Here's the Juan de Fuca plate diving underneath. And this kind of messy blue pile here is called the accretionary wedge. And what it essentially is about 30 million years of Columbia River sediments just being snow shoveled off of the top of the Juan de Fuca plate and just forming a big pile out here. It's the world's biggest recycling project, sort of. And so here's, if you turn Cascadia on its side, and we'll just run a little movie here, there's another thing that happens during earthquakes, and that's generation of submarine landslides along the continental slope, and turbidity currents, which are just muddy slurries of sediment that run out in the channels. And this is what John Adams discovered in the early 80s. And so if you go out on a ship and take a core sample, it looks like this, and these are the turbidites here, they're called, just stacked up. And so what John Adams did is he took some cores that were collected by OSU, oddly enough, in the 1960s that had been stored in the core repository down there, and he made a really clever observation. He noticed that the Mazama ash from Crater Lake, Mount Mazama, was found in the 13th of these beds down from the top. And so he wondered why that would be. Why would you find the same number of these beds all along the Cascadia coast here in all these different core samples? And he couldn't really come up with a reason except because all these submarine landslides could be generated by many different things, storms, random landslides, earthquakes, and all of that. So why the coincidence of them being the same? And he wound up deciding that was the most likely explanation was earthquakes. Earthquakes that ran all the way from Vancouver Island to California. And he also found that the number 13 applied to stream confluences too. So you had two arms of a confluence came together. There were 13 upon both sides and 13 below the confluence. And what that demonstrated is that these turbidity currents arrived at the confluence essentially 13 times in a row within an hour or so of each other. So John Adams, without ever leaving his desk or going to sea, basically told the story back in 1985. And so we've been, without going into too much more detail, we've been studying those cores and lots of new cores ever since, looking at the geophysical views of the cores using modern technology to analyze those cores and essentially put that desktop hypothesis to the test. So in this process, we essentially borrowed 70 years of oil field methodology to do what's called well log correlation from site to site to site. It's what the oil industry uses to track the oil-bearing sands in the Gulf Coast and the North Sea and so forth. And we just borrowed that technology and apply it to earthquakes. And the bottom line is you can correlate these deposits, I believe, over long distances in a way that you can't do with the onshore deposits. So it increases the certainty that you're talking about an event here is the same as an event there, and it allows you to measure also the length of the earthquake pretty well. And so this is our usual tool of choice, about a 300-foot ship. This is what it takes to take these core samples in deep water. So this is all NSF-funded work. This is the Tommy Thompson UW ship. About 60 people go to sea for about a month to collect all this kind of data, and then you wind up having essentially a lifetime's worth of analysis to do. But it turns out that lakes in the Pacific Northwest have the same records, and so we've been lately coring these lakes. This one's Lake Sawyer near Seattle, with a couple of Grumman canoes and a plywood sheet on top and hand-pushed cores. And you can essentially get the same record and just densify the whole system of measurements and also bring it inland closer to where our big cities are. So we've been working on a transect in Seattle and a transect through Portland that includes Bull Run Lake. It's in some work that's being supported by the Portland Water Bureau, interestingly enough. And so it turns out that you can correlate these deposits between the lakes and between the lakes and the offshore, which is sort of off the slide here. And we've come up with a strategy to test their records against other alternative storms, forest fires, and so forth that seems to be working. But this is just work in progress. So that's sort of the science in a really quick nutshell. So what I'd like to do is play a movie for you. And this is, some of you have seen this before, but this is an updated version. And what it shows is essentially the compilation of 30 years of this type of work, which is called paleoseismology, study of past earthquakes, and showing a 10,000-year earthquake record for Cascadia. And it's going to play at about 200 years a second. And there are 46 earthquakes in it, and let's see if we can go forward. And the dots on there are the data points from which this this stuff comes, and you'll see it varies from slide to slide. So we're starting at 10,000 years ago, playing forward 200 years a second, and you'll see every one of these earthquakes is different. There's some full-length ones like that. Big ones are indicated by brighter red and wider width. Small ones like that. This is the biggest of them all, 5,900 years ago. And after that, there was a period of quiescence up in the north part that lasted almost 1,200 years. Now we're down to about 3,400 years ago, and now you're seeing more land sites are kicking in. The land paleoseismic record is about 3,500 years long. The marine record is 10,000. The San Andreas Fault is on there, too. And possibly not coincidentally, about three-quarters of the San Andreas earthquakes happen roughly at the same time as Cascadia within radiocarbon errors. So raising sort of a grade B movie possibility of one triggering the other. And now we're down to the penultimate event, 500 years ago, T2, and then 1700 January 26, 9 o'clock at night.
Is that standard time or Pacific time?
Pacific time, actually. And so the very well-known earthquake of Japanese history, and also the Native Americans knew about this. Their version of it was called the Battle of Thunderbird and Whale, which you may have heard of. And the Battle of Thunderbird and Whale involved a lot of thrashing and a lot of washing away of villages. And once the geologists had figured this story out pretty well, the Native Americans pretty much just said, why didn't you just ask us? We knew about that. And it was called Thunderbird and Whale. And so here's a summary of the 46 earthquakes. So we have now 7 different flavors of different sizes. We have about 20 of them that ran the full length of Cascadia, as far as we know. 2 or 3 more that ran partway up the Washington coast. Another 8 or so that stop at about the Columbia River. 2 more that stop at about Newport. About 8 or 10 that stop at Cape Blanco, and a few that are even smaller than that, and a single one that just involves just the Washington coast. So as you can see, the main thing here that we're learning is that these earthquakes are not all the same. They're not all magnitude 9. They range in size from about high 7s up to 9. Maybe a 9.1 would be the maximum size. And that about half of them seem to be full length, and the other half seem to be these segments that are almost exclusively getting shorter and shorter toward the south. So what that means is the southern part of Cascadia has a much higher probability in an average time period, or in any time period, than the north part. These guys up here have about a 450-year repeat time, but if you live down in, say, southern Oregon and northern California, your repeat time drops to about 220 years. So that means their probabilities are roughly double in any slice of time. The only break they get, or that we all get, is that these earthquakes tend to be smaller. And by smaller, we're still talking magnitude 8 earthquakes, which is similar to 1906 earthquake that destroyed San Francisco. But we do get a break because our biggest cities are in the north, Portland, Vancouver, Seattle, and Victoria, or at the north end where the probabilities are lower. So that's, if we get a break at all, that's it.
That makes us feel better in southern Oregon.
Sorry about that. And so this sort of gruesome plot is just what that looks like graphically. This is a log-log plot showing probability. So when you get up to 99% up here, pretty high probability, and just time across the bottom. And so if you take time since the earthquake, 300 years, and go 50 years into the future, you've got about 360 years, roughly. And so these blue dots are the actual intervals between earthquakes. So how do we rate compared to, you know, have we gotten to the average time yet? That's sort of what this plot shows. And what this shows is that 50 years from now, most of the earthquake intervals for Washington and northern Oregon are still out in the future. We haven't got to the average time yet. On the other hand, if you look at southern Oregon, it's the other way around. With 360 years, 50 years into the future, we've gone past about 75% of all the repeat times already. So if you were, if this was a disk drive, 75% of them from the, out of the factory would have failed by now. And you've only got 7 or 6 that are longer than 360 years. So the average here is 220. So if we go back to the probability here for the northern margin, including, you know, most of Washington, is about 14-15% in 50 years. But when you go down to southernmost Cascadia, it jumps up quite a bit to about 37% in 50 years. And Portland and, say, Salem to Portland is right in between, and our probability is sitting at around 20 to 22% in the next 50 years. So this is a bit of an update from the work about 5 years ago. And so they're not, just to make it even more difficult to deal with, they're not spread out evenly in time. So this is all of the earthquakes, all of the bigger ones, shown in time with 10,000 years back here and zero time here. And so they seem to come in clusters. So here are 5 earthquakes in the last 1,500 years, and then a 1,000-year gap, and another 5 earthquakes, and then another 1,000-year gap. And then it's less clear what's going on back here. So when you think about probabilities, that counts on the fact that you're spreading them out evenly in time, but they're actually not spread out evenly in time at all. So we're sitting here, here's the you are here dot, and wondering if this cluster has one more left in it, which means we're overdue, or maybe it's done and we're going to have a 1,000-year gap, which would be fantastic. But there's just no way to say whether this kind of distribution could be random, or it could be driven by something, and we don't know which that is. It could be just completely flip of the coin, random, but it may actually be driven by connections to other faults, and it may keep repeating through time. And I wish I could say more than that. So Representative Evans asked me to make a few comments on stories of success, failures, and things like that, seen from other subduction zones. And, of course, this is what we all hope for, that the earthquake will ruin the Etch-a-Sketch gallery. But the reality of subduction zone earthquakes of this size is that they tend to look more like this. And believe it or not, these I just picked three slides at random from the Tohoku earthquake in 2011. And so these slides, believe it or not, this is what success looks like. So Japan is the most resilient country on Earth, and this is as good as it gets in a magnitude 9 earthquake. So the earthquake, you can do a lot about. The tsunami, less so. You know, the earthquake, you can engineer buildings, and they had very little building damage in Japan from the earthquake itself. All the damage was from the tsunami. And so it's a much, you know, much less tractable problem. But believe it or not, you know, this success, losing 20,000 people and having all this damage, was an order of magnitude 10 times better than Sumatra did. Sumatra and the Indian Ocean lost 250,000 people in a similar earthquake only a few years before. So that's the difference between preparation and education and no preparation whatsoever, 10 times different. And so in Oregon, where do we stand? Well, I think in the science community, we at least like to think that we have the geology pretty well in hand. You know, we've been working on this for 30 years, dozens of us. And in Japan, they really didn't have control of the risk, I mean, the hazard itself. They didn't have the geology right, and that was part of the failure in Japan. In the Pacific Northwest, we think we have the geology about right. I don't think we're looking at giant surprises anymore. But on the preparedness side, we're 1,200 years behind Japan. So we're just now learning about this. It's nobody's fault. We built our cities on top of a time bomb, and nobody knew it was there. But we've got a big problem. So we have a lot of unreinforced masonry buildings. Our own OSU campus is sort of an example that's mirrored in the big cities. About 60 or 70% of it is a collapse hazard. So the same as Portland, same as Vancouver, same as Seattle. It's really just across the board. And so these kind of buildings don't perform well in even small earthquakes. This is just a building that was destroyed by one of the fracking earthquakes in the Midwest, a magnitude 4 or something like that. So we've got a bit of a problem. And we've got a lot of bridges that, to my eye, don't look like they would stand up in a strong breeze and aren't going to perform well in earthquakes either. And, of course, we have, just in Oregon alone, we have 1,000 unreinforced masonry schools. To me, that's a high priority. Most of these were built, you know, long before there were earthquake issues and building codes applicable. But we're lagging far, far behind in taking care of this problem, I think. And so, Representative Evans asked me to make some comments about what works around the world and things that don't work. And so Japan, this is a really easy question. This is a very softball question because Japan is the place to look for things that work. Japan is a society that not only knows how to engineer for earthquakes, but they have a longer view of families and society. And they realize that if they build a school today, their children may not ride through the next earthquake in it, but their children's children will. Somebody will. And so they take a hundreds of years view of this kind of thing, and that may well just come from having 1,000 years of getting hammered by earthquakes again and again, and they finally have said enough. And so they take it very seriously. So this is just one example from Minami Sanriku in Japan, and this is featured in the OPB Unprepared show. And so what they've done, Here's Minami Sanriku being just after it was destroyed. So now they're planning on rebuilding the entire waterfront area of the town, and the way they're going to do it is they're going to raise the base level of the town from here, where it is, where the cones are, to here. So they're going to make it 4 meters higher above sea level than it was before. And when they finish that, they're going to put the whole town back on top. It's just a meadow now, so there's nothing left. So that's how seriously they take this issue in Japan. And so here's another example. Here's the base isolation of a hospital in Minami Sanriku. And they had another hospital that was pretty good. It was relatively recently built, And they did some new tsunami modeling and realized that the new hospital was just on the edge, just inside of the tsunami zone, and they decided to build a new hospital. They're not going to wait for this to age out and retire it. They're just going to build another one. And so they did. And this hospital, This hospital was finished and rode through the earthquake without so much as a broken light bulb. The phones lit up, of course, and people started arriving in ambulances and so forth, and it was completely operational 100% of the time. And so what this engineer is showing us here is the base isolation system, this giant spring, and it's sitting on a rubber donut, and that's how it all worked. And below here, this metal plate had a plumb bob hanging on it. Essentially, it's called a scratch plate, and it drew meter-long scribes on the ground as the building moved all around with no damage at all. So the example from around the world, there's really only one. It's Japan. Chile does pretty well, but nothing like Japan. And so they have, like I said, a 1,000-year head start, so we definitely have some big shoes to fill. And so here's the same town. This is Mayor Sato of Minami Sanriku, and this was the public safety building. It's actually the last building standing. This meadow back here was the town. And we met Mayor Sato there, and he's famous for being one of the people that hung on the cell tower as the entire town went underwater. So this is a view from the top of that building. And so 48 of the people in the building died while they were broadcasting radio messages to evacuate, and 10 of them survived by hanging on the railings and the cell tower. So Mayor Sato has some experience with this, and that explains why they're raising the base level of the town. He fought for federal funds to make that happen and won. And so I was also asked to comment on bringing that back to the Pacific Northwest. Japan, their society is different in a number of ways, and the government is also more top-down. So after that earthquake, Japan passed a national law about land use planning around Japan, and essentially from the top down said that in the red zone, which is more than 1 meter of inundation, you may do these activities. No dwellings, no factories with night shift operations. So you can have fish plants, you can have factory operations, as long as it's daytime only, and as long as there's a really good evacuation route set up. In the yellow zone, which is a little bit less dangerous, you have more activities that are okay in those zones, and the green zone is where everyone lives. And they're actually now shifting large numbers of businesses and homes to match this national law. And of course, you're getting a lot of flack from people. I've lived here all my life. I'm not moving. The usual sort of thing. But eventually, the national law will probably prevail, and they'll have a very nicely land use plan planning system that will be much more resilient than what they had in Northeast Japan. And so you could bring this back to the U.S. or down to Oregon, and Ian will talk more about some of these things. But we essentially leave these things up to individual communities and developers to make the decisions. We don't have a top-down land use system, really, with teeth in it. We have a new hospital built in the tsunami zone in Gold Beach. On the other end of the scale, we have the Seaside High School, which is now going to be moved out of the tsunami zone. So we have some wins and some losses. The kids in Seaside were fantastic. They had this GoFundMe campaign to raise money, got a lot of attention, and they made it happen. And so individual communities are making these decisions a little bit on their own, according to what, their priorities. And so I'm in the awkward position of working at OSU, and OSU is planning to build a school in the tsunami zone. And I upload it to your website, a letter from 23 of the geology faculty members all opposing it, which was essentially all the geologists that weren't on vacation at that moment. And so we think there's a lot of debate about this. And we, on the OSU side, they feel it's a cost-benefit thing. They want a marine science center that's right on the water, which is sort of an aesthetic thing. They argue that they need the seawater, which is actually just bay water pumped off of high tide. And they argue for the synergy of having OSU's building closely packed together with all the other federal agencies, federal and state agencies that are on that facility, which is true. From our point of view, we think this is not an engineering decision or a cost-benefit decision. We just feel that it's a moral error to put other people's children, our students, in a tsunami zone knowing what we know. Yes, we can engineer for it. Yes, it'll probably work. Should we do it? I would say no. And so that was our consensus at the OSU faculty, and I've spoken to a number of state and federal agency people who are interested in this issue, many of whom work there and really are not free to speak, and also other colleagues at other universities who are free to speak, and I found really no support for this anywhere outside of OSU. So my question, there is, what would Mayor Sato do if the city council of Newport supports this? They want the development and so forth. So this gets, I'm way out of my comfort zone, but you asked me to comment on this. I'm a geologist. I'm glad I don't have to make these decisions. But when science collides with society, this is the kind of thing that happens. And so I'm in favor of sensible land use planning that will go essentially follow the Japanese model and look 100 years into the future, or maybe 200 years. The probability of this site getting destroyed by a tsunami is up as high as 40% in the lifespan of the building, which is 100 years. And so when you knowingly build a school in a place like that, you're making a statement that you're essentially gambling with some students in the future. And I just don't think that a university of all organizations should be in that game. We're not developers, we're educators. And if we can't follow our own advice, then something's not right. So anyway, I'm in favor of a sustainable plan, but sustainable over the longer term, not 10 years, 20 years, but 100 years, and encourage people to build things that will last through the next earthquake and survive. This site, the Hatfield site, is a sandbar, and it'll return to a sandbar after the next tsunami. There won't be anything there. And so having that in the future, why not encourage people to build in a more resilient way so that an earthquake, as it is in Japan, is just a very exciting bad day, but not a disaster. And I think that's all I've got, so thanks very much.
Questions for Dr. Goldfinger? I know I have a couple, but before I... Yes?
More Vice of Chair a comment. Boone? Yes, I always feel like I should get 3 credits for sitting through one of your lectures. I love them.
You should.
You are so succinct, and you say some really deep and disturbing things with a smile, and we're all still here. But I do learn a lot from you, Dr. Goldfinger.
Thank you, Representative Boone.
Any other questions? Okay, I've got 2 or 3. And again, understand these are wags, wild guesses. All right?
No problem.
But given your studies up and down the coast and the relationship between the differing scales of magnitude of an earthquake and the impact upon infrastructure that you've seen in other places, if one end is Indonesia at 230,000 and the other end is Japan that was prepared and I think built a lot of things to an 8.0 earthquake or something like that and was close, but
yeah, right,
we'll build stronger next time at 20,000. In big picture terms, if the event were to happen tomorrow, what would the casualty count be, do you think?
Well,
could you walk us through, because you've seen it's globally.
Yeah, it's really, so that question, so in the big picture, we're much closer to Indonesia in terms of preparedness. We think we have the geology right, which Japan didn't, but we have very little education in preparedness, so we're closer to Indonesia. And we're essentially playing a little game of roulette, because our situation will vary a lot depending on time of day and time of year. So if we had this thing in the middle of January in a snowstorm, there's not going to be anybody on the beach, so the tsunami isn't going to... It will affect the towns, but it won't be during the kite-flying festival, during July or something like that. If you had it on, during that festival in July, it would be a different story. And the other thing that happens is that since most of the infrastructure that's at risk, the unreinforced masonry buildings, those are mostly workplaces, not homes. Homes are wood frame. If they're bolted and so forth, they perform quite well. But the URM buildings are workplaces. So if it happens in the middle of a workday, the outcome's going to be very different than if it happens at night when everybody's asleep. So I'm not the person to put numbers on it. I can just say that it's going to be very, very different depending on time of day and time of year.
And the second question is, in tsunami zone impact along the coast, what about for those people that think that they're safe by living in the Willamette Valley, that they don't live at the coast, so it's not a problem? What are the likely impacts of a major large-scale event?
Well, they're certainly free of the tsunami, but the tsunami won't, it'll propagate a little ways up the Columbia River, but it won't reach Portland. So they are free from that aspect of it, and we're 50 miles inland, more or less, and the shaking levels will be quite a bit lower. But the problem is we still have that URM, unreinforced masonry building problem, and those buildings are built to what engineers call gravity loads, meaning, and wind loads, meaning they'll stand up by themselves and they won't blow over in a breeze, and that's it. They don't perform well in even the smallest earthquakes, and subduction zone earthquakes can last 3 to 4 minutes, and so even very gentle shaking for that length of time will do tremendous amount of damage. So we're not in good shape from that perspective. It won't be the kind of shaking from subduction zone earthquakes is more gentle than what you're seeing and what you see from, say, videos from California with things flying off the shelves of the store, security cams and whatnot. Subduction zone earthquakes are not quite like that, but they're persistent and they'll just shake gently until the URM buildings come apart in 2 or 3 minutes. All our cities are, we have a little bit of break because we're inland. The Japanese cities are mostly right on the coast. But we'll still come out behind on that comparison.
Then the third question is basically just so folks that are following along at home, having been to Japan after the event and seeing kind of the impact upon not just the folks that live there but the nation, one of the things that I think sometimes people allow themselves the hollow comfort of is thinking, well, it's going to affect other people, not really going to affect me so much. If we get the full event from bottom to the top and it unleashes for 3 or 4 minutes, is it fair to say that most, if not all, of the folks that live in Oregon will be impacted in some way from that type of catastrophe?
Oh, yeah, I would say absolutely. Not just in Oregon, but the whole country. This is going to be the largest human disaster in North America. It might not affect people in burns directly. They'll certainly see it on TV and be aware of it. But essentially losing all the infrastructure in Western Oregon and Western Washington will be just, much of it will be just out of operation. For long periods of time. And the Oregon Resiliency Report lays down some of the schedule of how long it would take to put some of those sectors back into operation, and Ian can speak to that much more than I can. But indirectly it'll affect certainly people east of the Cascades and much of the rest of the country. Oregon and Seattle are major shipping ports in both directions, so it'll affect the country, and the economic disaster of it will be tremendous.
And the last question is, and I think you've already answered by some of your pictures, but problem real, impact large, but there are things that can be done. You've seen them with your own eyes, that some of these things can be mitigated if we actually do the work now. Is that also a fair
statement? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely true. So Japan is the model for a resilient society. They've been at this game for 1,000 years, and except for this error they made with the size of the earthquake that they were planning for, they got it right. If they'd gotten the size of the earthquake right, that the 20,000 they lost probably would have been more like 2,000, if people had evacuated far enough inland and high enough, for a 9 earthquake, they would have done probably 10 times better than they did. So my attitude is not doom and gloom. it's just the opposite. I've seen something that works. I was actually there during the earthquake, and I was we were in a building that was base isolated. It was well built. And we were at an earthquake meeting, ironically. There were like 40 of us at a meeting for the Indonesian earthquake. And we rode through the earthquake, and we strolled around watching the buildings move and watching the flagpoles whip around. And we could do that as observers because we knew we weren't going to be killed by the building we were in. We were guaranteed. And all there was a little sifting plaster, and that was it. And you could walk around the building and see no sign that anything had happened in a magnitude 9 earthquake. And that's how it should be. We can engineer for that. We're a wealthy country. There's no reason we can't do that. The Japanese have simply made a decision that that's where earthquakes fall in their priorities. They're not willing to be destroyed again and again and again. It's really not a matter of can't. It's just a matter of the resources to do it.
Thank you.
Any
other questions before it? Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been some information in recent months about fuel storage concerns related to liquefaction. Are you aware of anything that's being done to mitigate that at this point?
I'm not aware. Yume Wang would be the person to talk to. I don't know if you're aware of anything new, but I have not heard of anything being done.
Okay. Is there more than one fuel storage facility that would be at risk in Oregon?
Again, Ian?
Yeah.
Okay, only one. Sorry, I don't know the details.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
Yes? I might add on to that, too. That's the one, the tank farm in North Portland, is, I think, what you're talking about. And we did have a bill, Senate Bill 94, that had a variety of things involved with the bill, and one of them was to work with the ownership, but those tanks are privately owned, so that was an issue. It's hard. We could say you must do this, and then they could pick up and move back to California or something and leave them there.
To that point, there actually is a bill this session also that the State Resilience Officer and a number of folks are working on for secure pipelines and secure storage. That will be perhaps a segue into allowing for partnerships with privates to be able to do that.
Okay.
So it has not been addressed, but it is being thought about, and look forward to those conversations. We'll add you into that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wolfinger. I really appreciate your testimony. And please stay there if you want for the next round of what we're going to cover. But,
okay.
Sir, Dogami.
Yeah.
And please state for the record your name and your agency and go ahead and take it away.
Certainly. Chair Evans, members of the committee, again, my name is Ian Maiden. I'm the Chief Scientist and Deputy Director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, henceforth known as Dogami, because that's a mouthful otherwise. Okay, lovely. So I'm going to talk about the effects of these earthquakes I just described. As Chris has said, there's a tremendous amount of science behind these earthquakes and the understanding that they do occur, how frequently they occur. And so the next step is really what can we expect when these earthquakes happen? What kind of impacts can we see on the land and the built environment? And how can we develop accurate information about those impacts that people can use to do rational planning? Because as you've discussed here, you know, there's a potential for dramatic damage in the Willamette Valley. It really makes a difference whether there's catastrophic damage in the Willamette Valley or minor damage in the Willamette Valley in terms of how we apportion resources to try to fix things and become more resilient. So having a really good basis of technically sound, detailed information that describes both the hazard, how much is it going to shake, and the risk, what kind of infrastructure and buildings are in place, what are their vulnerabilities, how much damage can we expect, is really critical information in order to make a rational plan. Because the overall tab to fix everything is huge. We do have 50 years, we believe, to get ready, but it still is going to require serious prioritization, careful thought about sequencing, and triage in how we design this response. So that's what I'm going to go over here real quickly. And I just wanted to say, I was hired by Dogami in 1987 as a result of the discoveries of Brian Atwater. I started out as the seismic hazard geologist for Dogami, and my job at that time, in addition to doing this kind of research on earthquake effects, was to go around and try and convince people that the sky was falling. And so I spent the first 10 or 15 years of my career trying to convince people that we had a problem. And the question I always got was, well, why should I believe this? Why should I do anything about it? And I'm really encouraged after 30 years that the question that I now get when I talk to people about this is, I understand this is a problem. I know what I need to do about it. I'm trying to figure out how to pay for it. And so if you talk to ODOT, that's the attitude that they take. If you talk to the Tualatin Valley Water District or the Portland Water Bureau, that's the attitude that they're taking. They know it's a real problem. The technical solutions are not an issue. You can hire engineers in Oregon who know how to fix this stuff. It's really the question of how do you finance it over the long time, and again, how do you prioritize and sequence things so you're making a rational, sensible approach. And so one of the great advantages that we currently have is we have now a state resilience officer who is, and not that I'm going to tell him what his job is, but we have someone who's in a position to kind of help with that organization, that top-down prioritization and strategy as to how best to go about bringing all these disparate needs together into what is a limited funding environment. So with that, I'm going to show you some pretty pictures. The first thing I wanted to do was kind of reiterate Chris's point about the earthquake probabilities and the history. So this is my effort with this slide to try to encapsulate the variation of risk up and down the coast. So the lines that you see over here represent the earthquakes that have happened in the last 10,000 years, with the length of the line being proportional to the size. And so one of these lines here represents an earthquake that ruptures from Cape Mendocino down here up to about Coos Bay. And the ones that go off the end of the screen here represent the failure of the entire subduction zone. And so you can see, first off, there's quite a bit of variability. But the other thing that's really clear is that if you're the further south you are, the more of these earthquakes that you see. And so that's why when we talk about the probabilities, it really matters where you are. If you're all the way up here, you're only seeing these relatively small probabilities, and these are all, again, over the next 50 years. And as you go south, you get up to these really alarming probabilities. There's no fixed line in here. It's sort of a smear. But it's really important to keep that in mind. And one of the things that we often encounter is that people will conflate the magnitude 9 earthquake, which is really big, with the probability for magnitude 9s or 8.4s or 8.1s or 8.7s down here. So the areas that have very high probability do not necessarily mean that that is a probability for the absolute worst case scenario. However, this is a series of figures that shows simulations of ground shaking from 4 different scenario earthquakes that kind of represent those 4 segments that we showed you, starting from here, magnitude 8.1, 8.4, 8.7, and magnitude 9. And the point here is all of these damage scales are the same. So if you're in Brookings or Port Orford, it doesn't matter to you whether you get the 8.1 or the 9. It looks exactly the same. And the only real difference is the area that is impacted. And so at basically that band of high damage simply moves its way up the coast. The other thing to notice is that once you get up to the 8.7 here, it doesn't make any difference, really, for the whole state, whether it's that or the magnitude 9, because the rest of this earthquake is going on up here in the Puget Sound and British Columbia. One way to really think about a magnitude 9 earthquake, because, you know, California, the highest earthquakes they get are magnitude 8. Oregon, of course, everything is better here, so we get a magnitude 9. A magnitude 9 earthquake is essentially a bunch of magnitude 8s going off in sequence. It's like a string of firecrackers, not a bomb. And so at any given point along the coast, what you really are seeing is the effects of a couple of magnitude 8s that have happened right off of your immediate area, and then maybe a little bit of impact from ones that are going on up here. But when you go from an 8 to a 9, the shaking doesn't get a whole bunch more powerful. It simply covers a much larger area and lasts for a much longer time. The other thing to notice about this figure is that in all of these pictures, The I-5 corridor is kind of right on the border between moderate damage and light damage. And that's a really important question to answer because it makes a whole bunch of difference in terms of how, what we have to fix and how we're going to prioritize it. So several consequences that we're really clear about for this earthquake are the issue of ground failure. So an earthquake like this causes very strong ground shaking. It lasts from 3 to 5 minutes if it's a magnitude 9 earthquake. But the other thing that we know it will do is cause widespread landslides. Now, Oregon's a very landslide-prone part of the world. This month is record rainfall. We're seeing houses being damaged in the Portland area from landslide movement. We know that when we have a subduction zone earthquake, we are going to see thousands of earthquakes. This map here is a simulation that we did for the Oregon Resilience Plan. Areas where we, everywhere in these two colors here, we expect between 1 and 10 feet of ground movement due to landsliding. You cannot engineer to withstand that amount of ground failure. And so all sorts of lifelines that traverse the coast range here, highways, power lines, we expect to be substantially damaged. And it's not just a question of going in and putting in new pavement. The land is gone. And when we go out and look in the coast range now, we see tens of thousands of prehistoric landslides that have been triggered by these past earthquakes. It's a very real problem. Similarly, the problem of liquefaction, mentioned in the context of the energy hub up in the Portland Harbor, if you have poorly consolidated sand that's saturated, which is a common situation along rivers or along coastlines, you shake it really hard, it turns into goop, and you have dramatic damage that occurs along those areas. And so this map again shows in the hot colors here places where we expect several feet of ground movement, ground failure as a result of liquefaction. Very, very damaging. Most of the time, if you see really dramatic damage in earthquake images from far away and it's not a tsunami, it's probably liquefaction because it is such a damaging effect. Tsunamis, of course, Chris has shown you the pictures of the incredible damage in Japan. Our agency has gone through and produced a series of tsunami inundation maps for the entire coast. This is an example of one for Cannon Beach. We don't know what size the next earthquake is going to be. So what we have done is model a range of earthquakes from what we think the smallest likely one is to what we think the absolute biggest one possibly could be. And this is all based on the work that, that Dr. Goldfinger has done. And so we have what we call the T-shirt sizes of tsunami inundation zones, small, medium, large, extra large, and extra, extra large. And so for Cannon Beach, you can see the difference between the small and the extra, extra large is a little bit of town and the whole town. So it makes a big difference which one of these you get. When we've designed evacuation maps for these communities, we use the extra, extra large line because we want the evacuation zone to be a guarantee of safety. However, if one was trying to develop some sort of local land use planning around tsunami, you might decide that one of these smaller events encapsulated an appropriate level of risk for whatever you're trying to regulate. So we have a variety of information that's available here for people to use. The other thing to just briefly note is this graph over here shows the actual wave height at one spot here in this map area. And as you can see for the extra, extra large, the initial peak of the wave is 70 feet above sea level. We have modeled elevations up to about 100 feet above sea level down on the south coast in Brookings. More typically, the worst case scenario is 40 to 60 feet above sea level. But even the smaller waves here are in the 25 to 35 foot above sea level range. And again, cannot overstate how damaging tsunamis are. The assumption is that if you're exposed to tsunami flow deeper than about 3 feet, all buildings are destroyed with the exception of reinforced concrete or steel frame buildings. So for most Oregon communities, that's going to be very substantial damage. So our agency has embarked on a program of developing comprehensive earthquake, comprehensive natural hazard and risk studies for all Oregon communities. I've started this a couple years ago, and this is an example from Tillamook County. It includes landslide, flood, coastal erosion, tsunami, and earthquake hazard assessments. And so what we're showing you here is a draft of the first of these. It's going to be published here in the next couple of months for Tillamook County. And this is this map shows the strength of shaking expected throughout the county. And these graphs show expected building losses by community for that particular earthquake. What we've done is gone through and put every single building in the county into our database. We know the exactly where it's located. We know its age. We know its use. We know its value. We generally know something about its construction type. And then we use a computer simulation software that's produced by FEMA that will tell us how much damage to expect for each one of those buildings in this earthquake. And then we can aggregate that by community. And what we're showing here is the loss ratio. So for instance, for Nehalem, you're looking at between the tsunami portion and the earthquake portion, 65% of the value of the buildings in that community being lost in this earthquake. That's pretty close to complete destruction. Typically, when you run these things for hazards, you're down in the 5 to 10% loss ratio. So this is pretty darn extreme. We are in the process of completing this kind of modeling, at least for the earthquake portion, for every area that you see outlined in blue here. This work's being done with funding from FEMA. And we've actually made this a major focus of our agency's efforts and have put it into as a new KPM in our current budget bill to actually complete this work.
Just a question, and I like, this is great. Harney County?
This morning.
Well, Harney County has natural hazards as well. And so, Chair Evans, members of the committee, the reason that Harney County is included here is because the funding comes from FEMA, and they are interested in all hazards. They have been doing flood mapping in Harney County because there's a serious problem with flooding from the Silvies Rivers in the Burns community. And so we build on top of that flood hazard mapping to do the all hazard and risk study. So we're trying to find opportunities where there's a little bit of funding and a little bit of opportunity to complete this.
I want every county done. I want to make sure when people ask me, there's not a coast there yet.
Yeah.
So, okay, thank you. Proceed. Do you have a question? Go ahead.
Northeast Jackson County, there's not a whole heck of a lot out there.
Chair Evans, Representative Esquivel, I believe
Prospect,
that we're...
Butte Falls and...
That we're looking at Central Point, Butte Falls, White
Central
City.
Central Point's next to Medford. It's down south, farther south.
Then we may have gotten the outline of the map. If you'd like, I can send you a list of the communities that we're doing. It's pretty much everything to the north and east of Medford proper.
Well, then you've got White City, Eagle Point. Okay, that map's a little... Okay.
Good?
Yeah, and thank you, Ian. This is... I had an hour left to drop a bill that asked GoGami to update their assessment and had heard there were other possible legislative drafts out that do just that, but it appears that you guys are already on the ball in doing this and doing it in a much bigger way than what my bill would have done. So thank you.
Well, Chair Evans, Representative Boone, this is our stated goal. This is a major department focus. As I said, we've developed a new KPM about it. We have to find the money for it. Currently, FEMA is the source, but our budget bill does actually include a POP that makes the positions that do this work permanent. They've been LD for the last three biennia. This will give us the opportunity to go find that money to do the work. So I have one more slide for you, and this is just sort of a reminder. Oregon's kind of unique and fortunate in that we have the Oregon Resilience Plan, which is a major effort that was put on largely as a result of the work of Representative Boone that was completed in 2013 that took a look at the impacts of Cascadia subductions on earthquake on Oregon and really tried to answer the question of how prepared are we and what kind of, how long is it going to take us to get back to something that looks like normal? How long is it going to take to restore power and water and transportation and hospital services and all that sort of thing? And the answer in most cases is much longer than anyone can tolerate, months to years. And I just wanted to say that because, as Chris mentioned, you'd asked for examples from around the world or ideas as to things that people could do. There's a long list of recommendations embedded in this document that have not yet been acted on. In fact, only a few of them have been acted on. One of them was the resilience officer position. But I'd encourage you to take a look at it if you want a blueprint to things that the state could do to try to improve our resilience.
Thank you. Any questions for Ian? Okay. Thank you both for your testimony and your for lack of a better term, the slideshows that will certainly get people's attention. Sometimes people have to hear it, I guess, 30 years until they finally catch on. But two things. If, and again, I know this is probably available, but if you could send us the POP for the two positions, that would be helpful so we could perhaps be cheerleaders on the inside for those positions. And then, Dr. Goldfinger, as conversations continue to move forward about where and when we invest in public entities, especially schools dedicated to the study of tsunamis, if there's input or things like that you think would be helpful for us to know, certainly would appreciate updates on that so we might be able to help with the conversation. I happen to agree that the decisions we make with scarce resources are, in fact, moral documents and moral efforts, and we want to certainly do the best we can with that. So thank you both very much. In the time we have right now, I'm going to ask if Mr. John Corr can come forward, if John is here. And John, what I'd like to do, give you about maybe 10 minutes, and if that's not enough time today, we'd like to invite you back, because we want to make sure that Representative Boone has a chance to have a hearing on her bill before the whole rush for filing bills gets close to 5 o'clock, and I want to make sure and spare some time. So appreciate your patience very much. If you could, for the record, tell us who you are and what you do.
Sure, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Corr. I'm the Oregon Section Manager for the American Radio Relay League, which is the National Association for Ham Radio Operators here in the United States. And pleasure to be back here with you. Kennedy Post and I were in hearing yesterday on Senate Bill 2597 on distracted driving, and we're interested in there in restoring the exemption for ham radio operators from that legislation. So thank you for hearing me yesterday. Today, I wanted to talk a little bit about what we do within the Amateur Radio Emergency Service here in Oregon, and how it relates to Cascadia Rising and other hazards that we face here in the state. You should know that the Auxiliary Amateur Radio Service here in Oregon is a critical service when major disasters occur and all normal means of communications fail. We know from the FEMA exercises called Cascadia Rising that happened last June, major exercise, Oregon, Washington, were involved in that. There are many reports, I think, that would be of great value to the committee on the findings from Cascadia Rising and what the estimated impacts are on the state of Oregon. And if you wish to have that, I'd be glad to provide much of that information. Today I have the State of Oregon After Action Report from Cascadia Rising with me, and I'd be glad to leave that with you if you would like to have that.
Thank you. Yes, please.
But what they found was that when normal means of communications fail, as they would be in a major disaster, such as you just heard, FEMA estimates about two-thirds of communications would be cut off. And in Cascadia Rising, when that happened, the first day of the exercise, there was a four-hour blackout period when all normal means of communication between the state OEM communications, major communication centers, and all the county emergency operation centers were shut down, except for amateur radio. and we were the only ability to communicate between the state OEM and the counties around the state of Oregon. And we found that they concluded from that exercise that amateur radio was a critical mechanism for backup communications. We're not the primary means, but we try to provide backup communications. Where available, the state amateur radio network was utilized very successfully by local and tribal jurisdictions within the state EOC as an alternative means of communications during Cascadia Rising. And what they found in that first 4 hours was the whole ECC staff was looking at their phones. It didn't work. The internet didn't work. They had critical information that they had to get out to the counties around the state, and they had no way to do it. It was a kind of a clear moment. As a voluntary and unfunded organization within the field division of ARL, the major, the Amateur Radio Emergency Service, we train, we provide radio operators for local counties. We have about 18,000 amateurs that are licensed in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Core, I'm sorry, there's a question. Go ahead.
And I'm sorry to interrupt. Thank you, Mr.
Sorry.
John, I just want to ask you, go back to the point you made, because I think it's really important.
Yes.
When you said everything else electronically, for lack of a better word, was off.
Was off.
Amateur radio, ham radio is still on.
That's right.
Why? I know, but I want you to explain. Why would you guys still be going? What is the... What makes it happen?
Okay, the magic aspect of this thing. In 2008, we received a grant from Governor Kulongoski to outfit radio equipment in EOCs all over the state of Oregon. Similar equipment. This is digital radio equipment. We use high-frequency radios, and we bounce a radio signal off of the ionosphere to a distant location. And we can send messages back and forth. It's like radio email is basically what it is.
Cool.
We can send messages back and forth between the state and the counties as far away down into Utah and have that information be shared between these EOCs. So all you need is a radio, a ham radio. You need an antenna, a battery, generator, some other supply power, and a little bit of knowledge and training on how to do these sorts of things, and it can work really quite well. So that's what we do, and I'm hoping that maybe we can show show you a couple of slides here, since our time is very limited.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
You have my written testimony.
We do.
Here, so let's just take a look quickly, if we can, if I know how to run this. Okay, so here we are. Here are some pictures. This is taken during Cascadia Rising, during that first four-hour block of time. All the folks in the red vests are volunteer ham radio operators at the OEM ECC Center, sending out traffic from OEM around the counties. And the woman here on the right side is sending this digital traffic I talked about. You type all these messages into a computer. This computer is hooked up to the radio. Radio transmits a signal out to Utah, and the counties pick up those messages then from the station in Utah. So we can go out of region, and it doesn't depend on internet to do these sorts of things. There are about 500 volunteers like this in the state of Oregon that are working around the various groups. So here's some other things that we do. We build radio stations for the counties. On the left is a picture of the brand new Multnomah County trailer that the ham radio folks built, our volunteers built, from donated funds, donated skills, donated radio equipment. Beautiful piece of equipment. And it took them 3 years of fundraising and engineering to put that thing together, and it worked great. On the right side is actually one that I built for the city of Beaverton Emergency Operations Center, all donated equipment, and that's sitting in Beaverton's emergency management office today, and it's used all the time. It's in a case. You can pick it up. You can move it out, put it on a picnic table. You can put it in a tent. You can hook it up to car batteries, and it works. And in a disaster like this, that's the kind of communications gear that you need to have. Now, twice a year, we go out, we put out simulated emergency tests. We're having one April 22nd throughout the whole state, And we get everybody out on the radios, and they work under a specific scenario to move traffic and exercise their skills. Over here on the left is Alan over in Umatilla on his station there at the Umatilla Emergency Operations Center, and on the right is Paul Tuttle here from Washington County. So we work with in the field with emergency power, generators, batteries, solar systems. On the right there, we're doing some practice drills with Mountain Wave Search and Rescue. We also work with those folks. So this gets us all, it's fun, and it's a great public service. We also train volunteers, as you see here, in some of the computer skills that we need. And we have a new online training program you see on the right there that anybody can access on your iPhone, your iPad. I can tell you how to get to it if you want to just look at it. So we're very busy doing all these things. How am I doing on time?
About two or three more minutes to begin.
1 minute. Okay. Very good.
But there's good news at the end, I promise.
This gives you a general idea of what we're having. I just want to, in the minute I have, I just want to tell you that of the 18,000 amateur radio operators in the state that do these wonderful things for you folks and the people of Oregon, about 3% of these people are actually involved in public service. Most are not. We don't have anywhere near enough amateur radio operators to operate full scale on a major emergency. We could do it for maybe a day or two if people could get from their homes to the emergency operations centers. But we really need to find ways to bring more public people into public service, train them, get them involved, and support the state and the counties.
Okay. Well, sir, thank you very much for the presentation. Before I open up to questions, I just want to say two things. First, in 2007, you and your peers kept people alive for about 4 days
yes.
after the hurricane, which is why the governor, yes. We were able to convince the governor to take money out of the Strategic Investment Fund
That's right.
and get that equipment.
That's right.
And the second thing is Representative Post is our lead, our designated lead, to start up a work group to meet three or four times before the end of session to basically get the ground truth of to how can we help these 18,000 people and the 3% specifically that are involved in these activities get the training, the resources, how we can try to help make it a little easier for these folks and your teams to be able to operate. So Representative Post, it's a great organization, and I know he's very excited about being a part of that. We've talked offline about it.
Absolutely.
And just thank you for all that you do. And Judge, good to see you also in the room. Any questions for the speaker? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the things, and I was able to observe some of the exercise in that, and so one of the things I always ask about, what we know in the severe case, electrical power and a lot of other things is going to be out for a substantial amount of time in certain locations. So I'm trying to understand from this equipment what the backup is. Its battery is where it starts, it's battery operated. So what's the life of that? So if we're talking about a 2 or 3 week in some areas without electricity or other means, how do you sustain the equipment to keep the communications going?
Very good question. How do we run all this stuff? You've got to have power, and a lot of us use generators. So we would depend on the first thing, to go to the emergency management agencies that manage fuel under critical situations and get gasoline to run our generator from them. We have backup batteries, as I said, and you can always pull car batteries out of cars, which probably won't have any gasoline to run,
no.
and use them to power radio equipment. But you're right. It's a very difficult situation, and it won't last forever. So that's another thing we got to worry about. Fuels management is a big problem.
Yeah, we hear that all
the time. Representative Lively, one of the perhaps the Lend-Lease program could provide generators for that particular.
Yeah, I have locations in that. Sure.
Yeah. Representative Boone and then Representative
Thank
Post.
You. And if anybody's ever, I'm always happy to plug the wave and tidal energy sector, especially along the coast, and that's one of the main reasons why I've been doing it for all these years.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to add, I know you, John, talked a little bit about it at the beginning.
There was a bill that we heard in Judiciary yesterday that sort of removed, well, it didn't sort of, it removed these guys from the law that we currently have. Because a lot of times these guys are driving down a road and need to make a quick radio call and all that. And it was all cut out in a distracted driving bill that has great intentions. And I don't want to go take away from that. It had great intentions. But as soon as I read the bill and knew it was coming, I got a hold of these guys and said, you need to come in and testify, because I knew it would come to this here. These guys need to practice and do what they do for what's coming, for what we heard, thanks to our other guests today. So I really love what these guys do, and I am excited about working with them because I'm kind of a ham bone myself as far as I like to play on the radio a little bit. Not that radio, that radio. I also play on those kind of radios. And I love the fact that you can play with the skip and talk to guys in China. It's fun. So
it is
many
fun,
times.
And any of you that are interested in coming out and see what we do on April 22nd, we will be doing these practice drills. They'll be operating from the OEM and from many county EOCs in the state. And please, we'll set you up. Come see what they do.
I'm going to set a date.
Anybody?
Sure.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Just a comment. I've had some background in emergency management, and I think the history has been that ARES has been, it's a valuable, very valuable asset, but it's been greatly underused over the years, particularly at the local level. So I think whatever support we can provide is really important.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sir, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
And again, on the work group, the goal is to try to provide the legislature with two or three ideas of how we can make your job a little easier. Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We are now going to close the informational hearing that we just had. I'm actually going to move to public hearing and then concept at the last. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2140 with the intention of trying to have the public hearing soon enough, so if the representative needs to go get more signatures, do other things to the bills, not sure. But why don't you, Bradley, read the SMS and we can move forward.
House Bill 2140 adds seismic information to the list of required disclosures that sellers must provide to buyers of real property. There is a -2 amendment that changes the question in paragraph 8 of the statute from "Was the house constructed before 1973?" to "Was the house constructed before 1974?" Oregon, like other states, requires sellers of real property to disclose certain information to buyers, including information like the title, easement, water, the condition of the roof, pests, molds, use of lead-based paints, the condition of the household, etc. House Bill 2140 adds two questions about seismic risk to the list of disclosures that are required in real property transactions. First, was the house constructed before 1973? In the original bill as amended, the question becomes, was it constructed before 1974? And then secondly, if yes, has the house been bolted to the foundation? We've received revenue and fiscal statements both on the original bill and as amended, and there is no revenue impact on either the original or the amended, and there's minimal fiscal impact on both the original and the amended version.
Okay. Representative Boone, would you like to start and introduce your panel, please?
I will lead off on this. For the record, my name is Deborah Boone. I represent the beautiful upper left coast of Oregon, House District 32. And this is one of the recommendations of the House Resolution 3 bill from 2013, the Resilience Plan. And the city of Portland, where I was born and raised and educated, came to me and asked if we could do this bill, that they needed that. There were a series of several bills that I am introducing this session that you'll hear from me on. And so I was happy to do that. Anything to get this plan ticked off, all those recommendations ticked off. This is may seem like a housekeeping type thing, but they've done good work with this, and I'm going to turn it over to Daniel Eisenbeis and company.
Chair Evans, member of the Members of the committee, for the record, Dan Eisenbeis with the City of Portland. I'm here today with Carmen Merlo, the director of the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. Very much appreciate the committee's consideration of House Bill 2140, and here to speak in support of both the bill and the Dash 2 amendment. Also want to extend our thanks to Representative Boone for sponsoring this legislation. This is a fairly simple concept, but one that we think is important with benefits to all Oregonians as we work collectively to improve the resilience of Oregon for seismic events. So the bill adds a two-part question to the seller's disclosure statement for residential real estate. First, with the Dash 2 amendment, was the home constructed before 1974? That's the date that the first statewide building code was adopted in Oregon that ensured that all homes would be bolted to their foundations to resist lateral forces associated with seismic risk. And if yes, was it built before that date? Has it been bolted to the foundation? That's not necessarily information that would be evident in the course of a usual home inspection if the purchaser or inspector even knows to look for it. For instance, in a finished basement, an inspector might not have easy access to the walls where that retrofit work would have occurred. So this is really meant to raise awareness. It's not meant to compel anybody to take certain steps, but to mm-hmm. inform everybody who's involved in the real estate transaction process. With that, I'll turn things over to Carmen Merlo, but happy to address
Director
any questions.
Merlo.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, Carmen Merlo. I'm the director of the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. I also go by Kilo Golf 7 Bravo Tango Bravo. As you heard from Dr. Chris Goldfinger, the discovery of these great Cascadia subduction zone earthquakes in Oregon is really fairly recent. But subduction zone earthquakes are not the only seismic risk faced in Oregon. We also have local crustal faults. Much of our infrastructure, roads, bridges, telecommunications, water, sewer, all of it was built prior to an understanding of our seismic risk, and that includes single-family homes. In Portland alone, 70% of our single-family residential homes were built prior to 1970. And what that tells us is that those homes likely are not bolted to the foundation. Homes that are not strapped down will likely fall off their foundation, even during moderate shaking. It'll shear the utilities, and it'll make the house either uninhabitable or too expensive to retrofit. Unlike other hazards, earthquakes are not something that we want people to evacuate from. In fact, one of our main goals is to keep people safely in their homes. And that's because one of the lessons of Katrina is that when you displace residents from their neighborhoods, from their homes, from their communities, the chances of them coming back are very small, and that slows down the city's economic and social recovery. So, as Dan mentioned, the intent of this is really to raise awareness. It's not to require the seller to make any remedies to the property. And for these reasons, the City of Portland strongly urges you to support House Bill 2140. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Vice Chair Esquivel, go ahead and we'll work our way down that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of concerns about this bill. One is that why would we give a disclosure statement to someone that just made an offer instead of an accepted offer? That's the first one. In other words, just because I write an offer doesn't mean you're going to accept it. The seller won't accept it. Why would I divulge information to them prior to an accepted offer?
I'll take that one. Chair Evans, Representative Esquivel, the seller is required to disclose other...
Oh. On an accepted offer. See, we have if I offer to buy your house and you don't accept it, why would you give me a disclosure just because I wrote an offer? If you accept it, then you would because it's a contingency.
Correct?
Yes.
Am I dead on? Okay, it's a couple of realtors here. I'm sorry. But I think we could do that with a friendly amendment, if it's okay with you.
and that is upon accepted offer. The other thing is, I'm not sure that we're in the right arena. I understand the night prior to 1974 question, but as you said, if it's a finished basement, how's the inspector supposed to see it? Well, my question would be, how would the owner see it?
Any of the three that may...
Chair Evans, Representative Esquivel, again, the sellers only... if they don't know, they simply write, don't know. We're not asking...
Fine. Okay. Then I would suggest that we put this on a... on an inspector, because whether you do a whole house or you do an understructure inspection, those people are going to be out there looking at it. If it's a finished basement, it's a finished basement. I don't know what to tell you on that. Unless they tear about the drywall, which I don't think it'd be protected.
Go ahead.
Chair Evans, Representative Esquivel. The burden, to put the burden on the inspectors, we've heard from the inspectors very clearly that many of them are not qualified to determine whether or not the house is bolted to the foundation, particularly if, as you said, it's behind the drywall and it's already been done. We have met with the inspectors, and they strongly opposed a recommendation to put the onus on them to make that determination.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
If an inspector's doing it, I'm not buying that one. And the reason being is because if they're doing a dry rot inspection of the sill, they have to be looking at the sill, which it's bolted to.
Okay, so an area for further discussion. Okay. Yes, go ahead.
And I appreciate trying to educate the, I guess, the buyer of a potential home. And it's not the intention of this to create any potential remedy that the seller may have to do. But any time that you alert somebody that whether they did or did not do something, or is anything done or not done, it opens up a point of negotiation that will put additional requirements on the seller to remedy that. If somebody comes and says, somebody's coming from California, nothing bad about Californians, but they come up and maybe the seismic code there was everybody's doing it now, or when upon sale, suddenly it's going to put a different standard on what our community, our sellers are going to have to do. I'd like to see it, maybe be handled under the insurance, department of, if somebody's going to insure that property, State Farm, Farmers, whoever, has it been seismically upgraded, et cetera, and then so that the current owner or previous owner or, new owner can make those upgrades. Maybe they get a discount, or maybe if they get earthquake coverage. But I just as a realtor, as a practicing realtor, I know that it's difficult.
Is there a question for the panel?
No.
Okay.
This
is the first public hearing. Perhaps we can arrange for conversations offline to give suggestions.
Right.
But if you have questions, okay. Sir? Nope. Nope. One question? Go ahead.
I was wondering, would the panel be willing to work with Representative myself and iron this out? Because these are just small things, but actually they're kind of big things. So.
Is it? Okay. So. Any questions on this way? Okay.
Chair Evans, if I may.
Yes, please.
And just to address Representative Esquivel's question, yes, we'd be very willing to have further conversations about the bill. I think the concept behind the proposal in the bill is somewhat similar to the information that's provided in the seller's disclosure statement for the presence of insulation, for instance. In homes, which oftentimes in older homes is not present, but it does not mean that the home is defective. It's just information for the potential purchaser, so that they're better informed about making decisions for investments in the home moving forward.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for bringing this issue forward. It sounds like there's real interest in trying to find options.
Representative Boone? Yeah, I'm very happy to work with the two real estate pros on the committee. And I knew that was going to come up, when I looked at Representative Esquivel's face.
Okay. So, that's good.
I am just the Sherpa in this case. But this Sherpa is willing to meet and pick up another piece of the load.
It sounds like more ideas, more cooks are going to make the stew better. So thank you very much. Look forward to seeing this move forward. And Director Merlot, always good to see you back in Salem. And there is one more person that signed up for this, and I'm staring intently at Sean Cleave, who his comments may have just been amended a minute ago. But why don't you step up and tell us who you are and
sure.
which one
Representative is Evans, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave. I am the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Association of Realtors, testifying today in neutrality over House Bill 2140. Obviously, there's some good questions from the members of the committee who represent real estate transactions. With many more years than myself, I'd be happy to also participate in work group regarding the bill. I do want to thank the City of Portland. They came to us very, very early in the development of this legislation. Normally, as an association, we have some strong concerns about modifications to the seller's disclosure. For background, that was a form that was adopted into statute in 2003, and it was done so to give some consistency towards what those forms look like across the state. We have modified that a few times since 2003. From our perspective as practitioners, our desire is to make sure that those disclosures for the seller are things that a homeowner would or may very well know about their properties. Occasionally they may not, so having the I don't know is a good addition of the bill. We do have strong concerns that addition of additional criteria may not be that relevant to properties. 2 years ago we had a bill that we didn't like that would have required disclosure for properties that may be within a certain mileage of a rock quarry. That's not terribly material to the property. Our belief is this could be, is much more material to the property. And again, happy to have those conversations and make sure that the work product is satisfactory to the two realtors on the committee and to the chair of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments for? Okay, seeing none, and there's no other names on the list. Thank you very much for your input, and we will wrap you into the discussions. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2140. Hopefully we can have discussions and friendly amendments and moving it forward in the next 2 weeks. That would be great. Before we move on to the next issue, I just want to say once again thank you to Dr. Chris Goldfinger, Mr. Ian Madden, and John Morton. This has already left and gone back to do amateur radio stuff for coming forward and being a part of our informational hearing. The next thing on the agenda is I'm going to be opening up a work session for possible for introduction of a committee measure, and we're going to open up the work session for possible introduction of a committee measure.
Mr. Chair, I move the legislative concept LC 3492 dated January 23rd, 2017 be introduced as a committee bill.
And Representative Esquivel moves that legislative concept LC 3492 dated 23 January 2017 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Please remember, for discussion for these types of bills, you're not we're not going to take a roll call vote. It'll be basically whether anybody disapproves of it. It is simply consideration of a bill as a committee bill. It relates to, and we'll actually have Bradley what the summary is so people know what it is. It is one more tool to be discussed about in terms of financing seismic resilience activities. That's what the focus is. Go ahead.
Legislative Concept 3492 authorizes local governments to assess system development charges for disaster resilience and mitigation. Requires 10% of system development charges for disaster resilience and mitigation to be spent on state disaster resilience and mitigation priorities, and 90% to be spent on local and regional disaster resilience and mitigation priorities.
Again, it is for consideration purposes only. Is there any objection to entering this committee bill? Seeing none, it's introduced as a committee bill. Motion passes. Thank you very much. Before we leave today, one last item of business. actually two last items of business. Number one, welcome, Vice Chair Boone. We're very happy that you are here. We feel kind of like we're now full. And a welcome to Representative Lewis joining the legislature. And what is customary is the first day of the committee, and both of you were doing other things at that time. Would you like to introduce yourself or say anything about yourself to the committee, just as a matter of, hi, how you doing? Hello, I'm so-and-so.
I'm Deborah Boone, and I have served in the legislature now since 2004, when I was appointed to fill out an expired term of my friend and former LEV boss, Elaine Hobson. And before that, I spent 16 years as a legislative assistant to seven different legislators. Been in the building since 89. I've seen a lot come and go, and most of my committee, I've done all the committees except education and judiciary, and veterans and emergency prep have been in different permutations the whole time I've been on there. And Dr. Goldfinger was one of my first meetings, and I remember slumping down in the seat after hearing about this Cascadia event. But I'm happy to be here. Again, I represent House District 32, which is all of Clatsop County, half of Tillamook County. David Gomberg and I argue about where the line actually is, but that's nothing a problem here. So, and I go into Western Washington County, where I pick up banks, not Forest Grove, and a little bit further out, and do Gaston, part of Gaston.
Well, we're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rick Lewis. I'm a veteran of the Army. Served 3 years in the Army in the Vietnam era, and about 6.5 months in Iraq in 2005, training Iraqi police leadership. My background is law enforcement. I spent just a few months short of 40 years in law enforcement. Served as a police chief in three different Oregon cities. Most recently in Silverton, where I was chief for 12 years, retired in 2012. During my time as police chief there, I was also the city's emergency management coordinator, so I do have some background in emergency management as well. After my retirement, I ran for mayor and was elected in 2014, served one term and started on a second term when this came up, and I'm very happy to be here. And I did ask to be on this committee as well. So
excellent. Well, welcome aboard. Yes, sir.
I'd like to say that, first of all, welcome. And second of all, Representative Boone has been on this committee for a long time. I think her and I have been on this committee for about 10 or 12 years now, I think. Well,
yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. We're the old gray hairs.
You guys started when you were like 5 years old.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Maybe dead, not
politician. You
got a few here.
All right. Well, Representative Lewis, we have a number of work groups that are kind of, when I say work group, very low intensity, 3 or 4 meetings before the end of the session to basically queue up conversations. We'll talk offline about which one you might want to be helping with.
Be happy to.
Everybody else, this next week.
I think he volunteered for Aries. I heard that distinctly.
I think he might have. That's right. I'm ready for that. Over the course of this week, I'm going to be kind of stopping by everybody, making sure you're getting the support you need for your work group and see how I can be helpful. Lots of big ideas, lots of efforts. And again, I don't think the stakes can be underemphasized given what we heard today. We have a clock ticking, and we have lives and property to save. So thank you very much for everything you did, and have a wonderful rest of the day. This committee meeting is closed. So. Meeting is closed. So.